Hello, hello, hello. Truth About Markets in London.
That's right. We're in London for the Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4 FM. I was going to say I'm Max and you're Stacy, but I'm Stacy and you're Max.
Yeah, that is absolutely correct. Now, what were some of the major highlights this past week?
Well, the major highlights. Oh, Barack Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, what was that all about?
Well, we'll get to that in a second. It also ties in with another story, which is Bono spoke at the Tory Party conference.
Oh my God, that's always a bad sign.
The previous week he spoke to the Labour Party conference.
Oh, okay.
And I was reading a commentary in the Daily Mail, of all places, but Quentin Letts was writing, asking, what is it about this tax-dodging singer that makes that these politicians listen to him about, how to spend their tax dollars?
Mm-hmm. Well, who does he represent? Does he represent the constituents? Is he supposed to be representing the people because he sings pop songs? Is that who they think that he represents, or does he bring in more? Is he just like a dancing chicken or something? A circus geek? They just get him for media attention.
Well, in the Daily Mail, the Quentin Letts guy, the reason why I posted it to our site maxkaiser.com was because he used the exact argument that you've been using here on Resonance 104.4 FM on the Truth About Markets for the last 5 years. You've been saying that this whole Geldofian, Bonoian sort of feel-good sort of thing of wearing a colored bracelet and everything will be okay. But in fact, it's just about making yourself feel better. This is what this commentator says. It's like it's all about, this... All these baby boomer sort of politicians have a vague feeling that they want to feel good about things, and Bono makes them feel good about things, about caring about, poor people around the world.
He feels good because he allows himself to feel bad.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, he empathizes with the starving people. And that's all you need to do. You just need to empathize. You don't need to actually do anything.
Exactly.
Because his actions over the years, when you add them all up, have resulted in absolutely nothing. What he has done, though, is made tremendous fees for the bankers who have packaged a bunch of worthless bonds. And in fact, he now represents a private equity group. And he's out there looking for acquisitions, and basically he's figured out a way to extend the life of his rock and roll youthful brand to cross over to a middle-aged semi-geezer brand of, geezer politicians who want to somehow associate themselves with the youth out there. I guess, and he's dangerous, isn't he? Like Geldof was selling genetically modified corn to Africans, that type of thing.
Yeah, he was giving it to them and destroying their own markets and destroying any way that they had to rise out of poverty on their own. But, you mentioned a key phrase here is like Bono has done absolutely nothing, which brings us to the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah.
Which is, it's just too stunning. I woke up, went to maxkaiser.com, the first thing I do every morning, saw some comments from some posters on our site, people talking about referring to Obama's Nobel Prize. And for some, I just thought it was like some sort of goofing around. It didn't seem at all remotely possible that he actually won it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he won it. And they're saying that the Nobel Committee gave it to him because that he wants nuclear weapons. He wants to stop nuclear proliferation. But as we've discovered on Democracy Now!, the fact is that the U.S. is actually coming up with an entire new range of nuclear weapons and all sorts of advancement in this technology.
Yeah, yeah. He wants peace, and that's good for the peace prize. You don't actually have to do anything to bring about peace.
Plus, you have to remember, during the election campaign, he refused to rule out a nuclear attack on Iran.
Mm-hmm.
A first strike nuclear attack.
He's never spoken about peace ever. He has spoken about withdrawing some troops from Iraq and moving them over to Afghanistan.
Well, you're not allowed to talk about peace in America. So it's impossible for any U.S. politician to win the peace prize legitimately, because you're not allowed to. The population, the media, and therefore and much of the population will not allow you to speak about peace.
Right. So in 2008, the U.S. Treasury collected about $2.5 trillion in taxes. Three-quarters of a trillion went to bailouts, and the remainder went to the Pentagon.
So, that's right.
Last year, 2008, three-quarters of the entire dollar collected in taxes went to war. And the rest was bailouts to bankers who also support war. Who are the propaganda ministers of war, who trade companies like General Electric, who are in the business of war, Lockheed Martin, Marietta, etc. So the entire budget's based on war, either directly or indirectly. The president's never mentioned anything about peace. So what's up with the Nobel Committee? Are they on crack? Are they smoking crack? Are they brain dead? Or were they co-opted?
Well, it's these five members, and they feel... They just need to feel good about themselves.
Is it Bono's on the committee?
Well, they just need, you know, apparently they just need to, the words. It's like the equivalent of putting on a plastic wristband or wearing a red T-shirt.
Mm-hmm. Now you've got this faux prize. Peace prize for this faux president who's on his way to becoming Goldman Sachs president. As we know now from the log records that were released of Tim Geithner's hotline from Wall Street back and forth, and then he calls the president. Lloyd Blankfein, who runs the CEO of Goldman Sachs, calls Tim Geithner, and Tim Geithner then pops over to Obama's office. And we've said it before,
Well, you have to set this up for the people that don't know this.
Yeah.
The Associated Press, through a Freedom of Information request, received the records from Timothy Geithner's office since he's been Treasury Secretary, who he's met with in all his phone calls. And what they discovered that is often directly before or after a meeting with the president, Geithner will call and speak to a select group of top bankers on Wall Street. So they are directly being fed, you know, whatever information they want to the ear of the president or the president back to these bankers.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, with the assumption being that somehow these bankers are helping the economy in some way and they're not just pimps. So here you have Lloyd Blankfein, who's a pimp for the credit markets. He pimps out U.S. Treasury bonds as a way to fund the war machine. And I guess that makes Geithner his hoe.
Well, you know, this administration, there's a different flavor, basically, of corporation, of fascist corporatism, whatever, that runs the White House. So This administration is about Goldman Sachs and a select group of bankers. The previous administration was about Halliburton and a few oil giants.
Right.
So it seems like they each, maybe the corporations have, you know, spoken to each other and they agree to like hand the prize, the tax collecting prize, the war, you know, creating prize back and forth to each other.
Right. They take terms. Take turns who's going to be the Mac Daddy, which I think is, urban argo for the king of the pimps. And so depending on who the president is, somebody else takes a turn being Mac Daddy. So during Bush, it was Halliburton, and they got recapitalized by hundreds of billions of dollars. They're living large down there in the Penta ghetto. And then you've got this administration, which has Wall Street, Mac Daddy, living large down there in the neoliberal financial ghetto. Living large, Pimp Daddy, Mac Daddy. I'm pretty convinced that before the end of Obama's president, he's going to get one of those pink Cadillacs. I'm pretty sure we're going to see that coming soon.
Well, the other big news this week was that Ireland voted for the Lisbon Treaty. So yeah. Now we're going to have a, well, the rumors are that there will be a President Blair of Europe. So nobody has any choice in the matter.
Oh, my God.
They are, it's apparently just...
I knew I felt sick.
Essentially an appointed position.
Oh, my God.
And,
it's like passing a porcupine through
you. And at the same time, you know, in the past week, the Obama administration has been... Two things. They've been essentially lobbying to kick the UK... They kick the UK off of the permanent governing body of the IMF. So remember, here you saw that your two leading parties here, the Labour Party and the Tory Party, Conservatives, whatever, they've been meeting with Bono, who is telling these politicians to raise your taxes in order to give charity to the third world. Now, the UK is one of the largest.
By the way, China just did a deal to buy Hummer from General Motors. So the third world is going to be driving gas-guzzling Hummers. Go ahead.
So what was I saying? So, So you're the IMF. The UK is the largest, sponsor basically of the IMF. They give £26 billion, something crazy. They just get sent to the IMF. So now they're about to be kicked off the board. Because the U.S. doesn't want them on the board. Who do they want on the board? They just want four nations.
Yeah.
Well, the U.S., China, Japan, and the fourth is the EU. So it would then be Tony Blair, who is a head of the IMF governing body.
Right, right. Now, Tony Blair, what's up with this? I mean, here's a guy who is passing along the Downing Street memos, entertaining Saudi terrorists in his office, as we've talked about many times. He keeps getting kicked upstairs, doesn't he?
Well, but as I said, you know, I think this is an agreement that takes place between these various corporations. So the previous 10 years, we had Halliburton and oil services companies and oil giants.
Mm.
Control the global political economy. Now, you know, we knew what was going to take over the White House and the global economy and the global war machine when we saw Tony Blair went to JP Morgan, literally like 2 or 3 days after leaving Downing Street. So that's the thing. He joins JP Morgan, then he becomes president of the EU, over which now they will have ability to disperse IMF funds and, well, IMF chains, really, debt slavery chains.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, you have Bono telling your national leaders who have the ability to tax you and incarcerate you that tax your citizens more, take their money and give it to poor people on the one hand, right? On the other hand, your former prime minister is going to be the head of the IMF, essentially, who's going to be, enslaving them with debt.
Yeah, I'm starting to feel kind of bad for the Brits a little bit. You know, over the years we've made fun of them, but now I'm beginning to feel bad for them.
Well, I wouldn't, because you remember the other thing that's happened this week is now it turns out that house prices are the same as they were last year at this time.
Yeah.
So that's kept them quiet. They're not talking anymore. They're just like praying to God or Tony Blair or whoever that it just all stays the same.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, this past week, speaking of tax dodgers, you know, the Cayman Islands were bailed out by the UK taxpayer.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
How'd that happen?
Well, they didn't directly bail them out. What they did is the UK taxpayer is guaranteeing a £38 million loan to the Cayman Islands because the Cayman Islands went bankrupt because they don't have any tax revenue. And the 2,000 hedge funds and oligarchs that they harbor were, I guess, saying that, you know...
Well, they don't pay taxes.
Well, they don't pay taxes, but also they determine what they'll pay each year, like in fees. They decided, you know, we've had a bad year. People are withdrawing funds from our hedge funds. So you know what, Cayman Islands, we're not going to pay you. And tell it, you know, tough luck. What are you going to do?
Yeah, what do they pay? What do they pay for? Like water and electricity or something? Or like, what does it mean if the Cayman Islands goes bankrupt?
Well, they do. Yeah, they have, you know, like streets that need to be maintained and clean. They have water infrastructure, sewage infrastructure.
So the citizens of the Cayman Islands, which are marauding buccaneer hedge funds who don't pay taxes to anybody. Mm-hmm. They don't pay taxes even to their mothership or whatever it is. And so now they have to, how much money are they getting?
£38 million in order to pay the salaries of the government workers there.
Okay, the administrators who rubber stamp all the illegal money laundering that goes on.
Yeah, but they've ruled out, like, because the hedge funds threatened to leave.
Yeah.
If they were taxed.
Right. So the pirates have incredible political leverage in these territories that allow them to operate without paying taxes.
Yeah, but I think, like, I really think we should just, if you're a banker or a hedge fund manager, they should be all given titles of lord. Because that's how we treat them. And that's, like, I hate the hypocrisy of, like, all this, you know, stupid stuff. They're a special class, and they should be. We should be able to identify them easier. Like they should, like we should have to bow in front of them because that's the essentially what we do. Because if there's no sort of protest at all, that nobody cares here in London. I haven't seen one single placard, one single request to protest outside Downing Street about bailing out the Cayman Islands. Then they deserve, those 2,000 hedge funds deserve a special, like, title. They deserve something special.
Oh, yeah. So they're going to stay there in the Caymans.
Yeah, of course.
And the Caymans they're getting their money from the British people.
They're getting their money from the British people. Like,
because there's an incredible, important component of the economy by allowing the hedge funds to launder money there.
Yeah, and they threaten to leave, and it's always this big threat to leave. Where to?
Okay, well, economically, what do hedge funds do? I mean, they launder money.
Well, they launder money. They circulate money. The velocity of money increases.
But that's laundering money. You know, and the classic definition of money laundering is to wash it through a third party, so then have it come back to you, quote unquote, clean. And in the Cayman Islands, for example, are where many of these hedge funds operate that are buying U.S. government treasury securities as the way to prop up the U.S. Treasury bond market so that the U.S. Treasury can say, Tim Geithner can say to Lloyd Blankfein on the phone, you see, we've got huge demand for our treasury bond market. Meanwhile, they're all filtering and all being laundered through Cayman Island hedge fund, and it all comes off of the U.S. Treasury's back, which through an off-balance sheet item and a secret account or an unregistered account. And, this is just adding immeasurably to the instability of the system. And, of course, the people who are starting to wake up to this are buying gold bullion.
Well, that brings us to the other giant story of this past week. Which was gold soaring. And it happened since Tuesday.
Yeah.
When Robert Fisk in The Independent wrote a story which absolutely roiled world markets. It created all sorts of turmoil.
Yeah.
In it, and this is also covered in our television program, On the Edge, this week. We cover this story where Robert Fisk says that his sources have revealed to him that there have been secret meetings between China Japan, France, and the Gulf oil producing nations to price oil in a basket of currencies, which would include the euro, the yuan, the new Gulf currency that will happen within the next decade, and gold. So he says in his article that this will happen within the next 9 years. However, it caused the dollar to tumble, and in particular against gold, which is a currency, and the price of gold went up to like almost 160.
$1,060. Right. Well, it's inching up. It's not soaring. I mean, soaring is when the price of gold jumps by $200 an ounce in one day. Then you could say it's soaring. You know, it's making a 20% move in a day. That's a soaring price. What we're seeing now is just the quiet accumulation of gold bullion by smart money that knows that the banking system is crashing and that governments are pursuing absolutely the wrong policies. And in the U.S., you've got Geithner and Obama with Lloyd Blankfein at Goldman Sachs conspiring, basically, to crash the economy and to the benefit of Goldman Sachs and gold owners. I like the headlines. It was kind of interesting on Drudge and these other aggregators. They were saying that the gold bullion holders are behind this move to create this basket that'll be partially composed of gold, and the gold bullion hoarders and the gold bullion owners are behind these news stories about the dollar crashing. And let me just go on record and say unequivocally that yes, it is the gold hoarders and the gold bullion owners who are talking about the dollar's demise, because gold is honest money and the U.S. dollar is dishonest money. I am for honest money, and I am against dishonest money. So therefore, for 5 years, when we started the show, gold was at about $400 an ounce. It's now over 1,000. It's heading to 2,000, as we've been saying, for 5 years. And it is basically an indictment of the American, British, neoliberal, fiat currency, fractional reserve banking nightmare. And of course, we're behind the rise of gold, because it's going to be the only way to de-dollarize, decapitalize the war meisters and the crooks in Washington and Wall Street. And as gold goes higher, their ability to perpetrate their model of destruction and bad economics is going to be destroyed. That's my way of pushing back against, you know, where's Bono on this? You see, if Bono and Geldof had a noodle in their collective skull, they would join the gold bullion crowd. They don't know that what they do is simply to feed their perceived enemy. Just like, as we've said on the show before, a group like Greenpeace has 100 million euros in the bank. And when I talked to them and I said, you know, your bank just lends that money out to the people you think you're fighting. And in fact, by hoarding all that cash and keeping in the bank as you do, you know, for every dollar that you collect, you're creating $5 worth of eco damage. You know, they just look at me like, what's a bank? What's a euro? What are you talking about? We like to hang ourselves from a bridge with a banner. Don't you get it? We take photos. Yeah, but it just doesn't add up. If any of that stuff worked, they would have had an impact by now, but they haven't. The only people who are going to snuff out the American war machine and debt machine are the gold vigilantes, of which I am one of the gold vigilantes, and all the listeners on this show are gold vigilantes. Everyone who has a brain in their head as a gold vigilante, you would be technically, I think, a vegetable if you did not understand that only gold will push back against the excesses and shortcomings of these so-called political folks.
Well, you speak of gold vigilantes, and there used to be a thing called bond vigilantes.
Yeah.
And under Volcker's era, they were pretty big. And these are the investors who would demand more interest if they thought they saw inflation,
mm-hmm.
inflationary policies by the government. I remember Bill Clinton, basically they whooped Bill Clinton very early on, and they basically forced him to make all sorts of cuts
mm-hmm.
in government spending.
Mm.
But those people, obviously, these so-called bond vigilantes are no longer exist because,
no.
look, you saw George Bush doubled the deficit. In
mm-hmm.
It took all the previous presidents before him. He doubled their deficit. So
there well, like we're saying with the bond vigilantes, you see, if the bond vigilantes show up and say, we're going to dump bonds because we think you guys are crooks, they just go open their Cayman Island accounts and they buy the bonds. So,
yeah, that's
you
know what I'm right. saying? That's
they
what I was going to say.
They don't have enough. Oh, I'm
plus,
sorry.
Plus you have more
oh,
of the.
I think I'll just jump out this window.
But no, but plus you have all of the, you have governments like China and Japan have been just flooding the market with purchases of U.S. Treasury bonds over the last 10 years as well. That seems something new compared to the 80s and 90s.
So the bond vigilantes are ineffective. Therefore, we need to rely on the gold vigilantes. Now, everyone out there should be buying ounces of gold because as the supply dries up. You know, aside from peak oil, you know, we've also got peak gold. The amount of gold being pulled out of the ground is declining, just like the amount of oil being pulled out of the ground is declining. So this is a good play, one any way you slice it.
Speaking of peak oil, that is a story in the Independent today, another article from the Independent. And I have this posted to maxkaiser.com, and it's about the North Sea oil. You know, the reserves are you know, the output anyway is plummeting because all the easy to get oil from the North Sea oil reserves have been got.
Hmm.
Now, the UK has an extremely high tax rate on this. So they tax oil companies 50%, and the tax rate on the older fields is 75%.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, I mean, we threaten countries like Venezuela, which charges with taxes less than that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so the UK government receives about £20 billion a year from tax revenue on North Sea oil.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're well past the halfway point on the oil reserves.
Right.
The output is declining even faster. So these oil giants are trying to get they're lobbying the UK government to lower taxes
mm-hmm.
on the oil so that it would encourage them to do this the riskier, deeper drills.
Yeah, because they want people fill their car up with gas cheaper, so they can get to the unemployment line sooner.
Yeah. Well, and it's crazy because PricewaterhouseCoopers, remember we covered this story last year, they found that all of that £20 billion a year that the UK tax, the UK government takes in from oil revenues,
mm-hmm.
where did it all go? They took that money and they cut taxes on property speculation. Basically, so they drove people into property speculation. They encouraged them to go into that.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, yeah, they could have created an entire sort of different energy structure.
Yeah, well, that's right. And now, according to something I read in the paper this morning, you know, they're talking about the reindustrialization of Britain.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that would be, you know, the problem is, British people, that you had Margaret Thatcher in office, and she deindustrialized your country and closed the coal mines and sold off all of the North Sea oil to finance the neoliberal big bang on the City of London in 1987, which made you the croupier and money laundering capital of the world for 20, 25 years until 2007, when that period of history ended. And now people are scrambling around thinking, oh, let's reopen the coal mines. Let's start drilling for oil again. And of course, Scotland is going to devolve. How come Scotland can devolve And it's part of like this thing, well, oh, we're just going to devolve and we're going to set up our own little parliament here and build some huge parliamentary whinging hall. What do they call that place? And, but in, you know, Ireland, of course, it's some kind of freaking revolution. Why can't Ireland just devolve? It seems if you say devolve, everything's peaceful and nice.
Devolution, so they could vote to leave the union.
Yeah, why can't Ireland just vote to leave the union? Is it just a matter of semantics? They should just say, we want to devolve. They're okay, yeah, that's fine. Hey, cheerio.
Well, no, that's a political thing that often doesn't make sense. So this is what brings us back to the bond vigilantes. Like China and Japan lose money on all their U.S. Treasury bonds.
Yeah.
But it's not about money. It's not about, it doesn't make any sense economically or, you know, on paper. But politically, there are political agendas.
Because the economics has ceased to fulfill its primary objective, which is to distribute risk and reward equanimically over the largest swathe of the population. It now serves only to finance the cacocracy in charge, ruled by the least qualified, as they perpetuate their money laundering schemes and call that economics. It has nothing to do with economics. It's neo-feudalism. But people who are living in their little houses in Britain and see that their house prices have stopped collapsing momentarily believe that, well, it's okay. It's all good, mate. We're going to be back in the roses soon. Our house prices have stopped crashing.
In they've stopped crashing in pound terms. They're still crashing in euro.
And gold.
And gold, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they gave the average house price what it was last year and then what it is this year. And you could do it online. Just Google it. You could easily find out what it was in euro last year and what it is this year.
Yeah.
And it is down about 17%.
Yeah, basic services will be cut off. No electricity, no sewer. Gangs of thugs, yobs, roaming around, committing antisocial acts, antibehavioral, antisocial acts about your home.
Hey, you know, speaking of a topsy-turvy world with chaos and all sorts of...
Obama's a yob, I think.
Obama's a yob, but
he's
listen.
A chav. Obama's a chav, you know? He should be wearing a Burberry... Furry Burberry fedora.
Well, what I want to say is that we've seen a lot of shark jumping. We're starting
to other people.
We're noticing this trend of shark jumping.
Mm.
You know, the famous scene in Happy Days when the series jumped the shark. Well, it created a phrase called jumping the shark when Fonzie was water skiing and the shark came up behind him and he jumped over the shark.
Right.
Anyway, it was so absurd, and it basically now, you know, is a phrase that suggests that, like, a sort of period of time or
every show takes the premise too far.
Too far, yeah.
You know, like when the Brady Bunch went to Hawaii or whatever before that, or, you know, just they take the basic premise, they run out of scripts, and they just take it one step too far, and they jump the shark.
That's right. So... That's what I was thinking when the Nobel Committee awarded the Nobel Peace Prize to Obama, that it had jumped the shark.
It did. It took the basic premise of Peace Prize, and they gave it to some guy who's thinking about peace.
Well, and you could probably say that the Conservative Party this week jumped the shark by having Bono there. I mean, literally, like, where is he? Like a Manchurian sort of, well, he's like a Forrest Gump of creepy sort of politicians, like... So he was buddies with Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, and now that they're going to be out of power, he's like shifting over to the Tories, and the Tories welcome him into the weird... And it was like a Big Brother thing. So Bono wasn't actually there in person. He was beamed in by via satellite, but on this giant screen above all these old, fuddy conservative people.
Mm-hmm. Well, his avatar was there? It wasn't even just the Bono avatar.
Well, I don't know what he said, but I'm sure it had something like, we've always been at war with East Asia.
We will continue to be at war with East Asia.
Yeah, so that brings us back to, speaking of wars in East Asia, or Eurasia, is, you know, Obama getting the Peace Prize. And, like, he's literally sitting there right now determining whether or not to send another 40,000 troops to Afghanistan. And apparently in his acceptance, you know, when he spoke in the Rose Garden yesterday morning to accept the prize, to say, wow, this is great, you know, the Peace Prize, he did mention the Afghanistan theater. Awkwardly, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. He's a merciful warlord.
He feels bad about it.
He feels bad about the people he's killing.
Especially from those unmanned drones from 30,000 feet.
Yeah, they should rename the drones to the Nobels. So America dropped some Nobels over Pakistan today, killed three innocent families.
Yeah, they dropped some Nobel Peace Prizes. They should, like, literally have some Nobel Peace Prize trophies. They should create, like, Oscar sort of trophies.
Yeah, you know, like in the World War II, the bombers had pictures of tigers or naked women on the bombs or the fighter jets. They should have a Nobel Peace Prize image on all the drones that Obama's using to murder innocent Pakistanis every day.
Well, but also, you know, I think George Orwell deserves special mention here. Nobody saw it so crisp and clear, the future, as George Orwell. I mean, literally now, war is peace.
Yeah, you know, he wrote that book down and out in Paris and London, just two blocks from here.
He did.
It's now an ice cream shop at the moment. It's one of those cursed locations that changes every 6 months, probably because the ghost of Orwell is screwing everybody up.
Yeah, but it was a slum back then.
Yeah, no, it was a horrible slum, yeah, during his days. You know, he was down and out in London and Paris. And, well, Pimp Daddy Obama, he's, what's his next move? Is he going to get the Time Man of the Year? I think he already that once or twice.
The rumor is that Michelle is going to be
Person of the Year?
Person of the Year, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think Obama's going to win the National Football League Player of the Year, and he's going to get an Oscar for a movie he's thinking about doing. And he's going to get the National Basketball Association's Player of the Year for the career he thought he might have as a basketball player.
Well, talk about that, because you had an interesting comment on MaxKaiser.com this week when, you know, Obama, it was prompted by Obama winning the Peace Prize for his thinking about dismantling the nuclear arsenal. Nothing has at all changed at all since he came into power. But you talked about time.
Yes, yes. We're talking about this, that because of, you know, what is neoliberalism, you know, the Milton Friedmanism and the post-neoliberal period of economics, it's all about transactions. You know, neoliberalism is that laissez-faire supply and demand capitalism you read about in Wealth of Nations. Neoliberalism is just transactions for really transaction's sake. So this is monetarism and the idea that you can manage the economy by just adjusting the rate of monetary policy and interest rates, and this will either speed up or slow down the transactions. And transactions are the root of the economy. It has nothing to do with supply and demand or anything that came before it. And, of course, starting in the 1970s, then you had bankers creating futures contracts based on these transactions. And this led to the markets becoming somewhat inverted, if you will, where you had the amount of futures contracts was way, way in excess of the underlying properties or interests or material or market that they were trading against. Okay, this is the definition of a derivative, isn't it? The derivative derives its value from the underlying asset. So we saw this in 1987, the amount of so-called portfolio insurance, which was a derivative product that was meant to ensure your stock market holdings, became so huge as related to the value of the stock market that it tipped over, it capsized, and you had the crash of 1987. And you've seen this ever since then grow exponentially every single year, especially fueled by deregulation, the elimination of Glass-Steagall, the increase of capital ratios in 2004 by Greenspan from 12 to 1 to 30 to 1. And now you've got $600 or $700 trillion in derivatives versus a global GDP of, what, 40 to 50 trillion. So there's an inversion of the derivatives over the underlying assets. And the futures contracts that represent basically a derivative product, they all are related to options and futures contracts. They're all, those are derivative products. And you've got, especially in the last few years, this idea where the futures contracts are closing more rapidly than the timeline, the chronology of what they should be represents. So in other words, you know, a futures contract or an options contract is good for a certain period of time and at a certain price. But the need to book profits instantaneously is so great these days, and the deregulation curve has happened so outrageously outside any normal economic considerations that you've got things happening now. The futures contracts are happening, are closing quicker than the time itself happens. So we have this, we have an effect backwardation in time. So we're going backwards in time. So Obama's winning the Peace Prize before he does anything to deserve the Peace Prize. And this is creating a situation where we're now thinking of Obama in the past because, in other words, he's finished now. He won his Peace Prize, so there's nothing. He's in the past now. You think of him in the past because they cashed in already on his Peace Prize. Anything that was geared toward the Peace Prize has now been cashed in. So this trend carries over across all the economic and political spectrum. So things are happening now so rapidly that and that they're actually affecting the time-space continuum using these futures contracts, and you're trading time futures effectively, and in so doing, you're traveling in effect backwards through time. And we saw this also with the 9/11 crash. Remember, guys at Apple Computer, including Steve Jobs, they backdated their stock options on buying Apple stock to the post 9/11 low price. So they were able to go backwards in time and pick an option strike price based on that catastrophe, which is one of the other tragedies of that event, is that you had all these executives cashing in on the low stock prices that resulted as a result of the tragedy by backdating stock options after the price of the stock had already moved higher. So again, looking backwards in time. And if you can go backwards in time and pick a price from the past and then capitalize it today, that not only are you trading on inside information, but you're going against all the laws of physics, and you're saying that the laws of physics don't apply to me, to you. I am above the laws of physics. I am God. You know, this is the problem with Wall Street people like Lloyd Blankfein at Goldman Sachs. He believes he is God. And if you could travel backwards and forwards through time and trade on prices that were in the future that you're going to mastermind using illegal trades, or go backwards in time and pick prices illegally, you would think of yourself as God too. And since nobody is telling them they're not God, and since they're collecting all of the money and reinstituting neo-feudalism, and as we saw in that report, which was from the insurance companies that are capitalizing by buying life insurance on employees and then cashing them in for the company when the employees are dead, they refer to it as peasant insurance, don't they?
Yeah, yeah, they do, where they cash in on their peasants.
Yeah, it's peasant insurance. So all these companies have peasant insurance, is what they call it, which is that they've got insurance on their employees. When their employees die for whatever reason, the company gets the benefits from the insurance, not the family.
Yeah, but that's important to address, to look at as just a microcosm of the big macro story, because we get asked all the time, and I hear all the time and see on forum boards, like why would bankers want the world economy to collapse? Because don't they get hurt? Don't they lose out? But it's, you have to look at it as they have lots of peasant insurance. Like we all live in the peasant economy.
Yeah.
And they have insured it many times over.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, they prefer the peasant economy to die because they actually make a lot more money from that.
Right. I mean, look at the reorganization after the fake bond and economic collapse of 2008. As a result of the reorganizations, CIT Group, which is an insurance company, they were reinsured in a way that if the company goes out of business, the American people lose something like $2 or $3 billion, and Goldman Sachs makes $1 billion. So that's peasant insurance right there. Goldman Sachs makes $1 billion, and the peasants lose $2 or $3 billion.
Yeah, via the taxpayer. Again, this is wealth redistribution. It used to be called socialism and Marxism, and was discouraged in the U.S. Certainly to go the other way is demonized. If it goes from Goldman Sachs via the government to the people, yeah, that's considered bad. But if it goes from the people via government to Goldman Sachs, it's considered somehow like free market capitalism, the epitome of how a global economy is created.
Yeah, if one of Obama's living in the mainland of America is going after a minimum wage increase from $8 an hour or whatever the minimum wage is to $8.20 an hour, they're considered socialist, wealth redistributing communists. Meanwhile, Goldman works out a deal where if they kill the peasants, they make a $2 billion bonus. That's considered a hallmark of free market capitalism. You're a sucker. Same thing in Britain. You know, I mean, it's more or less, you know, they've got the same things in place. I can't give you the as specific examples as we do in the U.S. market, but just cut and paste the names to your local banking hoes and...
Well, in the UK, there's more of this weird reliance on this middleman of Bono and Geldof.
Yeah, well, he looked better in a dress, I think. He should start wearing, isn't he, where's he from? Ireland, right? Don't they wear kilts and stuff? Or is that Scotland, I guess?
Why don't we just, it's hard to say Bono and Geldof, though. I think we should call them just, like...
Gelbo.
What's that?
Gelbo.
Gelbo? Bondoff.
Bondoff and Geldo. Where is Geldof these days? He hasn't opened his pie hole right lately. What's he up to?
Well, he doesn't really get invited so much to those party conferences.
No? Why?
Bono's stealing his thunder this week.
Where is he? We haven't heard from him. Is he finally figured out he needs to just retire and keep quiet for a while?
Well, I know he was very worried about his share price, wasn't he? He was saying like share price should be higher.
Yeah, I mean, that was amazing. Based on his activism, his share price should be higher. Now, is there any more clear indication that their priorities are mixed up?
Well, their priorities, maybe it's the audience who's messed up. They just choose to ignore a certain side.
Well, what's it? Okay, the name of the company is what? 10 Alps?
Yeah.
Okay. However many shares there are in 10 Alps Corporation, let's say there's 100 million shares, he should double the size of the shares and give 100 million people each one share.
Well, he should give the Africans one share.
Yeah, he should give 100 million Africans one share of 10 Alps, double the capitalization, and his earnings would be cut in half. But, you know, that's not the point. The point is not to make as much as you possibly can. The point is to increase this commonwealth as much as you can. You see, he's fallen into the trap thinking that if he makes a lot of money, it's all trickled down and it's good in the end, which is absolutely false. And that's what we told him when we interviewed him on our show in Paris 5 years ago. We made that point to him directly, and he had no way to, you know, come back to it. He's not in the business of defending the commonwealth as he should be. If he were, he would double or triple the number of shares outstanding in 10 Alps and distribute them to 100 million or however many shares there are to the folks in Africa who could then participate directly in his activities as stakeholders and the commonwealth of their joint activities of singing Kumbaya all day and promoting various programs would have a net beneficial impact to a wide array of stakeholders.
Bravo. Very good idea. I think we should pitch it to him.
Well, first of all, you'd have to explain to him what a share is, you know, and what a stock is. I mean, he doesn't know anything. I don't think, you know, he's one of these guys. Like, but these guys, they are not financially literate. This is obvious. I can prove it in 20 seconds. If you put me in a room with either one of those guys, in 20 seconds, I can prove that they are financially illiterate. I'll be happy to do so at any time of their choosing, any place. Bring them on.
That's right. So what else do you have to talk about? We've got 8 minutes left, We got a lot of complaints last week that you kind of started mumbling and wandered off topic, really? And you didn't have anything to say.
I was mumbling.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can't mumble these last 8 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Because otherwise I'll be bombarded with hate mail.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What else do you want to talk about?
Well, I think we need to address what?
Let's talk about Latvia, because Latvia is in the news, and we actually already spoke to Michael Hudson about this, and he's going to be on the edge this week coming up.
Exciting.
Because Latvia was being advised by Michael Hudson, who went up there, and he spoke to the prime minister of the country, or he spoke to politicians who informed the prime minister, and he advised them that they should basically, you know, I'm paraphrasing it all, but that they should just not pay any of the debts that they owe to Sweden. Because, you know, post the fall of the Soviet Union and communism, the Baltic states became like were like thrust into the arms of the EU. And because they did not have their own developed and this is the same case that happens in the third world, you see. They didn't have their own banking infrastructure. So what happened is about 90% of their banking infrastructure is now provided by Western nations, mostly Scandinavia and primarily Sweden. So they, rather than, you know, invest in Latvia or Estonia or Lithuania for, you know, to develop capitalism, they developed speculation. So they encouraged everybody to speculate on house prices. And they had a giant housing bubble. But all of the loans were issued in, almost all of the loans were issued in euro, not the Latvian lat.
Yes.
So now that the crisis is upon the world and the banking industry and credit dried up, and the house prices are down 71% in Latvia.
Oh, geez, that's a lot.
Yeah. But then now they owe it in euro.
Yeah.
And so all the peasants are suffering. And now Sweden is trying to strong arming them with the help of the rest of the EU and the IMF is trying to force Latvia to slash all sorts of spending, cut healthcare spending by 50%, and try to use that money to pay back the Swedish banks. Now Michael Hudson is advising that they just convert all the loans back to Latvian lats and devalue their currency.
Yeah, it's a good recommendation, isn't it? And he's causing all kinds of political tension.
Well, he is, and he was.
Because they're taking his advice.
Well, in the news, and I sent you some of these articles earlier this week, but you see that Michael Hudson was attacked by the Swedish government and banks, and they called him a populist because the Latvian prime minister suggested this. He proposed a new law that would...
What does it mean to be called a populist in this context?
That he
represents the interests of the people, and the government is saying that's not good?
Well, apparently populist is a bad word. It's some... perhaps evocative in a way that socialist or Marxist or communist, all these words are thrown out at people. But you have to, I don't know, you know, it'd be a good documentary or a good news item to see what the people of the Baltic region who are very recently in the arms of a Soviet system.
Yeah.
Like, how are they better off with debt peonage or with lack of choice peonage? I don't know. You know, like how free are they now? They could have 1,000 choices at the supermarket now, but if they don't even have the option to be able to afford it,
right?
What's the big deal? Like, who cares if you have no money anyway? If you're offered one loaf of, you know, the choice of one loaf of bread or 1,000 loaf of breads.
Yeah, well, it gets back to basic, you know what, they should go back to home economics. You know, when I was in junior high school, we took home economics. Did you ever take that?
I sure did.
And it's a pretty simple concept. You know, the home has a certain monthly overhead, And the idea is to make at least that much or more on a monthly basis. So the country, in this case, needs to think in these terms. They have a certain monthly obligations that they have to meet, and they need to cover that in some way. And simply becoming gambleaholics and you know, speculating in the currency markets is not anything to do with economics or home economics. It's just you're degenerate gambler is what happens. These countries become degenerate gamblers with the nation's currency because they're sold this bag of worms by some fast-talking City of London or Wall Street stockbroker, banker who's got the next big whiz-bang guaranteed going to triple your money, you know, song and dance. As far as populism goes, there needs to be at least one. There used to be in various countries what they called the fourth estate, which was the press. And the press used to at least report on how the government was squandering the public's money. But of course, the press in the U.S. has become embedded. The press in the U.K. has become embedded to a large degree, although you still have guys like Robert Fisk, who is telling really what's really going on. But I guess in these Baltic countries, they don't really have enough of a free press. I know the press is not.
No, the press are free around the world to cover when, like, poor people are squandering the public's money.
Yeah.
Not when the rich people are. And you saw that in the U.S. with the case of Acorn.
Mm-hmm.
Well, whatever, you know, they did wrong and whatever fraud they committed, you know, a few bad apples there did. Because if we're going to call the Halliburton bad apples, and the Blackwater bad apples, mm-hmm. and the whole Bush administration people bad apples, then, you know, let's use the same terms. Let's compare apples and apples. So this group Acorn, which helps poor people, like they help them avoid foreclosure. They were one of the very, very first groups actually to start warning about the subprime crisis, like years before.
Yeah.
But anyway, they received $53 million in contracts over the last 15 years. 15 years, $53 million.
Mm-hmm.
And look, you would think that this was a giant, massive corporation that had defrauded the government of billions and billions. But it's $53 million they've earned over 15 years.
Hmm.
When Halliburton, or, you know, I won't name names, but some corporations steal that in a day.
Well, Jeremy Scahill had a good report on this, right? The amount of the defense contractors, according to Bernie Sanders. No, Bernie Sanders, yes. Talking about, he's the independent senator from Vermont, that the defense contractors, using the same standards, were pilfering many hundreds of billions of dollars, and yet they're not questioned at all for basically doing the same thing.
Exactly. And because the media doesn't pay attention to it and doesn't present it in the same way, then the population itself, you don't get brown shirts like screeching and running around going, oh my God, the private military contractors are stealing, defrauding us of billions. But they'll go like, they'll screech, you know, it's mostly like peasants themselves that are screeching about their fellow peasants. But
mm-hmm.
That's
one thing about peasants. They're pretty reliable in that way. All right, so we'll see y'all next week. Bye, y'all.